and leased the ship on a yearly term. Lauderback was Balfour's contemporary in age, and yet from that first meeting the latter deferred to him almost as a son to a father, showing a touch of vanity, perhaps, for the aspects of Lauderback's person Balfour most admired were the same aspects he cultivated in his own. Something of a friendship formed between the two, a friendship that was rather too admiring on Balfour's part ever to develop into intimacy, and for the next 2 years the virtue ran unimpeded between Dunedin and Melbourne. The insurance clause, for all it had been painstakingly crafted, was never consulted again. In January 1865, Robert Harnett declared his intention to retire, sold his shares to his partner, and moved north to milder climes. Balfour, with a typical absence of sentiment, relinquished the harbour-front lot immediately. Otago's boom was past its prime, he knew. The valleys were rutted. The rivers would soon be dry. He sailed to the coast, purchased a bare patch of land near the mouth of the Hokitika River, strung up his tent, and began to build a warehouse. Balfour and Harnett became Balfour Shipping. Balfour bought an embroidered vest and a derby hat, and around him the town of Hokitika began to rise. When the bark Godspeed pulled into the Hokitika roadstead some months later, Balfour recalled the name and identified the ship as belonging to Alistair Lauderback. As a gesture of politeness, he introduced himself to the ship's master, Francis Carver, and thereafter enjoyed a cordial relationship with the man, formed on the nominal bond of their mutual connection, though privately Balfour thought Mr. Carver rather thuggish and had pegged him for a crook. He held this opinion without bitterness. Balfour was not awed by force of will, unless it was of the sort that Lauderback displayed, charismatic, even charmed, and he could not love a villain. The rumours that dogged Mr. Carver at his heels did not intimidate him, and nor did they strike a chord of boyish admiration in his heart. Carver simply did not interest him, and he wasted no energy in his dismissal. In late 1865, Balfour read in the paper that Alistair Lauderback was set to run for the Westland seat in Parliament, and some weeks after that, Balfour received a letter from the man himself requesting the shipping agent's collaboration once again. In his campaign to win the Westland province, Lauderback wrote, he wished to appear as a Westland man. He entreated Balfour to secure lodgings for him in central Hokitika, to furnish the rooms appropriately, and to facilitate the shipment of a trunk of personal effects, law books and papers and so forth, that would be of crucial importance to him over the course of his campaign. Each item of business was described in the expansive, flourishing script that Balfour associated in his mind with a man who could afford to waste his ink on curlicues. The thought made him smile. He liked to forgive Lauderback his many extravagances. Lauderback himself would not arrive by ship. Instead, he would make his passage overland, crossing the mountains on horseback to arrive triumphal at the heel of the Arahura Valley. He would make his entrance not as a pampered statesman travelling in comfort in a first-class berth, but as a man of the people, saddle-sore, muddied, and stained with the sweat of his own brow. Balfour made these arrangements as he was instructed. He secured for Lauderback a suite of rooms overlooking the Hokitika beachfront, and registered his name at all the clubs that advertised craps and American bowls. He put in an order at the general store for pears, washed rind cheese, and candied Jamaica ginger. He solicited a barber. He rented a private box at the Opera House for the months of February and March. He informed the editor of the West Coast Times that Lauderback would be making the journey from Canterbury via the Alpine Pass, and suggested that a sympathetic mention of this brave endeavour would recommend the newspaper most favourably to Lauderback's future administration, should he win the Westland seat, as he was likely to do. Balfour then dispatched a message to Port Chalmers, instructing the master of the Virtue to collect Lauderback's trunk, once it had been sent down from Lyttelton, and convey it to Hokitika on the clipper ship's next circuit to the coast. Once all this was done, he bought a demijohn of stout from the Gridiron Hotel, put up his heels, and quaffed it, reflecting as he did so that he might have liked politics, the speeches, the campaigning. Yes, he might have liked it very well indeed. But, as it happened, Alistair Lauderback's arrival in Hokitika was not accompanied by the burst of fanfare that the politician had envisaged when he first set down his plans in his letter to Balfour. His expedition across the Alps indeed captured the attention of the diggers on the coast, and his name indeed featured very prominently in every gazette and newspaper in town, but not at all for the reasons that he had intended. The story recorded by the duty sergeant and published the next morning in the West Coast Times was this. Some 2 hours' ride from their final destination, Lauderback and his company of aides had happened to pass the dwelling of a hermit. It had been hours since their last refreshment, and night was falling. They stopped, intending to request a flask of water and, if the dwelling's owner would oblige them, a hot meal. They knocked on the door of the hut and received no answer, but by the lamplight and the smoke issuing from the chimney, it was evident that someone was inside. The door was not latched. Lauderback entered. He found the dwelling's owner slumped dead at his kitchen table, so freshly dead, he later told the sergeant, that the kettle was still boiling on the range and had not yet run dry. The hermit appeared to have died of drink. One hand was still curled around the base of a bottle of spirits, near empty, on the table before him, and the room smelled very strongly of liquor. Lauderback admitted that the three men did then refresh themselves with tea and damper on the hermit's stove before journeying on. They did not stop for longer than a half hour, on account of the dead man's presence in the room, though his head was resting on his arms, which was a mercy, and his eyes were closed. On the outskirts of Hokitika, their company was further delayed. As they advanced upon the township, they came upon a woman, utterly insensate and soaking wet, lying in the middle of the thoroughfare. She was alive, but only barely. Lauderback guessed that she had been drugged, but he could not elicit any kind of intelligence from her beyond a moan. He dispatched his aides to find a duty sergeant, lifted her body out of the mud, and, while he waited for his aides to return, reflected that his electoral campaign was off to a rather morbid start. The first three introductions he would make in town would be with the magistrate, the coroner, and the editor of the West Coast Times. In the 2 weeks following this ill-starred arrival, Hokitika did not pay the impending elections much mind. It seemed that the death of a hermit and the fate of a whore—this, as Lauderback soon discovered, was the profession of the woman in the road—were subjects with which an electoral candidacy could not be expected to compete. Lauderback's passage over the mountains was only very briefly mentioned in the West Coast Times, though two columns were devoted to his description of the dead man, Crosby Wells. Lauderback was unperturbed by this. He was anticipating the